From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudet. This is Idaho Matters. The level of COVID-19 is up in Boise, that at least according to the spike of the disease found in the city's wastewater. Also, we know bird flu is hitting Idaho's dairy cows, but what about beef cattle? Well, joining us now to talk more about all of this is Dr. David Pate, the former CEO of St. Luke's Health System. And remember, if you have a public health question, send us an email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Hi, Dr. Pate.
Hi, Gemma.
So, Dr. Pate, let's start with what wastewater is showing us here in Boise. Are we heading for another COVID surge?
Well, it's yes is the answer. It's a little bit unclear to me exactly. Of course, we don't have all the testing that we used to have, but certainly we talked about a couple of new variants, KP.2 and KP.3. And the first one's referred to as a flirt variant. The second one is a fluke. And we've seen these in other countries first. So I've gotten an opportunity to see how they're behaving. And what happened in the United States is we started seeing that first one, the KP.2 or the flirt mutation, we started seeing that on the West Coast. And so Hawaii, California, and then Washington. And so we saw it on the West. Then we saw it start increasing in the southern states, particularly Southwest, and then less in the eastern and Midwestern states, although it's increasing there now. So what it looks like in the Boise water is that we have been having a surge, and it looks like from the CDC data that that is most likely KP.2, that flirt variant. And I say that because we've stopped doing the sequencing here, so I can just look at levels. But if you look at what's been happening in the United States, KP.2 was on the rise, but now we're seeing what we've seen in many other countries, and that is that the KP.3, the fluke variant, has also been increasing, but as in other countries, it appears to be more fit, which means it will take over and exceed KP.2, and that's what's been happening nationally for the last several weeks, is KP.3 is actually outpacing KP.2, even though KP.2 got the head start. So what's the significance of that? Well, in the Western states, including us, where we saw the earlier rise of KP.2, and now that's actually going down, it means that we've had a wave and we may get another one as KP.3 increases. And we've seen that in other countries. What it means for example, the opposite coast, the East Coast and maybe the Midwest, since they've been late to get KP.2, they may just kind of get a single surge as KP.3 already is gaining traction, and it just creates what appears to be one surge, even though it'll be both KP.2 and KP.3 infections. What does that mean for listeners? Well, What's not clear is, could you get infected with both? If you got infected with KP.2, as many people here recently have, will that mean that you're less likely to get infected by KP.3 if it does surge here? I don't know the answer to that. And certainly there are some big differences between these two in terms of immune evasion. So I think it's possible we could see people turning around, having COVID, and now turn around and getting infected with COVID again soon. I just don't know. The good news is that protection from severe disease, if you were previously infected or if you've been getting your shots, you're still going to be protected from that. Neither of these variants is getting around that. But where we are seeing severe disease in people who are particularly older or have medical problems and have not been keeping up with their boosters.
Okay. Well, speaking of that, Dr. Pate, Ray wrote a question saying, my last COVID shot was in November of last year. I was due for another one in March, but did not get it. Should I get one now or wait until my next doctor's visit in September in the hope that there might be a more current vaccine available? And this also goes into some new information around recommendations from the FDA concerning the COVID-19 vaccine.
Yes. So that's a great question, Ray. And what I would say is my recommendation would be to encourage you to get the booster now. And the reason I say booster is because it's the updated vaccine that was released in September. And Ray, you say you got it in November. That's great. What we would recommend is you wait 4 months, which we're past that, and now get a second dose. And that's because you're in your 70s, you're in the highest risk age group, and you mentioned that you also have medical issues. These are the people that we're seeing getting hospitalized if they're not keeping up with boosters. And I understand your concern because we're already on to new variants that are different than what the shots were based on. But the good news is a study just recently came out and showed that if you keep up with these shots, even though they lag behind what the current variant is, you develop a better and a broader immune response to those vaccines and do get enhanced protection. So, Ray, I would get that booster now, and then you'll still be available to get the new version that will come out this fall. And then, Gemma, as you pointed out, the FDA's vaccine committee met at the beginning of June, and they made a recommendation for the updated COVID vaccine that will be coming out this fall. It surprised a number of us that they recommended JN.1 be the basis for that. That JN.1 pretty much took over infections of all the variants at the beginning of this calendar year. And it kind of faded out right about that same time, the beginning of June. We still have a little bit of it, but not much. And so many of us were surprised, well, why did they go with JN.1, which was clearly fading out by the time they made this recommendation, rather than the KP.2, that flirt variant that I mentioned to you that has started on the increase, and we are seeing grow very strongly in across the world. And then as a surprise, just a couple of weeks later, they came back and modified their recommendation. They said that to the manufacturers, if you can, make the booster KP.2. If not, go with the JN.1. I think that was to accommodate Novavax, who had already come out with a JN.1 vaccine, and I think they didn't want to discourage that. But I'm hopeful that at least one or more of the companies will make a KP.2 vaccine for this fall. We'll have to see, but it will at least be based on JN.1.
Okay. And then what about this idea that we might at some point see a COVID influenza vaccine combo come out?
Yeah, this is interesting. So Moderna has come out and just published, or well, they didn't publish, but they made an announcement that their studies from phase 3 clinical trials showed that their combination COVID vaccine, the new updated one, but they haven't told us which variant it's based on. My guess is this is a JN.1, but I'm guessing because I can't find it anywhere. But they combined that one with a seasonal flu vaccine so that you could get one shot. Now, the question is, when you get two vaccines like that, do you get a better or a worse response than getting them separately? And what their study shows, apparently it hadn't been published yet, but they report, is that actually there were superior immune responses to getting it as a combined vaccine. And that might be encouraging to people, especially if it's inconvenient for people to go two different times, once to get your COVID shot and then once to time the flu vaccine, listeners will remember last fall I was helping them strategically time when to get their flu shot because it doesn't last as long. But so if you're going to get this, you have to get them both at the same time. You might lose some of that strategic planning. But for those people that they might not go to the doctor twice to get it, that, you know, it's going to be like, if I'm going to get it, you got to do it. I'm giving you one shot. Well, this is a great solution for those people. And it showed that they got a better response to both the SARS-CoV-2 virus and to the influenza A virus and even the influenza B virus. So it was very encouraging. We'll see if it gets approved. I suspect it will.
And then Dr. Pate, how are studies looking for the COVID nasal vaccine?
Well, I would have lost this bet, Gemma. I would have guessed that the nasal vaccines would not be very encouraging. Why? One, they have not been particularly great historically. And second is that we know people are getting infected in their upper airways and then they're getting reinfected months later. And so you wouldn't think that that nasal immune response was that effective, but I've been shown to be wrong. In fact, the study was, at least the results, the early results they're reporting, and it's going into phase three trials, looks extremely encouraging. And this could be a game changer. One is you would be surprised, maybe you wouldn't, but a lot of people would be surprised how many people have a dreadful fear of needles. And so the opportunity to get a nasal vaccine could be really appealing to them. And second, if the nasal vaccine were made, the government could decide to make it easier for us to get it rather than having to go to a doctor's office or hospital where you have to get the shot and then be supervised and so forth. So that could be a real convenience factor. But the second thing is that whereas the shots have not done a great job of protecting us from infection, from transmission and infection of the virus, they've done a wonderful job of protecting us from getting seriously ill. It looks like these nasal vaccines may help us do both and probably even better if you get the nasal and perhaps get the injection as well for those that are willing to do it. So we have to wait for those studies to come out, but the early evidence is extremely encouraging and I'm truly surprised, but pleasantly so.
Well, absolutely. Especially as you said, Dr. Pate, I think for people who just have such a fear of needles, I mean, this really can be a game changer.
Absolutely. And of course, people have got all these, you know, there's all this misinformation about the current vaccines, but I think nasal vaccines, they are safer. And I think people will probably take it that wouldn't possibly have taken the regular vaccine. So this could be a real game changer for us.
So Dr. Pate, Susan writes, dairies measure daily feed consumed and milk produced for each cow. They use an automatic system for that. Beef producers do not measure for these. I understand that H5N1 has been diagnosed in dairy cows who are nearly symptom-free based on lower feed intake and lower milk yield. So how do we know beef herds are not affected by H5N1 or sheep or goats? Could H5N1 be far, could be spreading more in livestock than we know?
Well, Susan, first of all, that's a brilliant insight. And that is my fear. I don't think we're doing enough testing. My guess is from your sophisticated question that you're probably aware that Idaho is the state in which we detected for the first time alpacas being infected with this virus. So I have certainly suspicions that there probably are many other species of animals that are infected that we don't even know about. I don't know very much about farming, but I talked to somebody that does, And I asked, are dairy cattle and beef cattle ever mixed together? And I was told absolutely not. Assuming I got the right answer, that would give us, you know, some reassurance. However, we have seen this virus transmit from a dairy farm to a poultry farm that were separated. And so it's certainly theoretically possible. The problem is we haven't been testing the beef cattle. So I don't know. And I'm not aware of any tests on beef cattle. It's possible it's happened and I'm not aware of it, but I'm not aware of any. And I don't think we know the answer to that question. What is concerning plenty enough is the infections going on in the dairy cattle, and that we have not stopped that transmission yet, especially when a study just came out showing that, in fact, the virus is getting modified by the infection in the dairy cows and picking up, at least in experiments we can do, that it is going to be more transmissible to humans because of these cow infections. So this is, my level of concern has only continued to rise since March. I think our government could do a lot more to help stem my concern, but without seeing us doing much to mitigate this, I'm getting increasingly concerned.
So with that said, Dr. Pate, Dory writes in, what is the receptor for the bird flu virus? And do humans have any of these receptors or receptors that are similar?
So, you know, the honest answer is we don't actually know the exact receptor like we do for the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the ACE2 receptor. What we know is characteristics of the receptor. In other words, if there are receptors that contain a sugar on the protein called the alpha-2-3 linked sialic acid, then that is the preferred receptor from the avian virus, the bird flu virus. Now, the studies have shown that that's not totally required for infection, but that may be something that promotes transmission among species that get infected. Whereas in humans, when we talk about the seasonal influenza A viruses, they prefer the alpha-2-6 sialic acid sugar on the receptors. And the reason that 2-3 versus 2-6 makes a difference is it affects the shape of the protein on the virus that will fit the receptor. So avian bird flu viruses don't fit human receptors very well. And however, we have discovered that humans do have that alpha-2-3, which is preferred by avian influenza viruses, in our eyes. And that's why you have heard some reports of people getting conjunctivitis with it. What is really concerning is that these viruses swap parts. And so there's 8 parts to an influenza virus. And if you have a bird flu virus that gets mixed with a swine virus or a human virus, they can exchange any of these 8 parts. And depending on how that exchanges, now it can shift its preference for the alpha-2-3, which we don't have much, if any, in our airways, so that we don't typically get sick with it, but that can shift it so it now can infect humans. And if you look back to all of the pandemics we've had since the 1900s, everybody will remember the 1918 flu, the Spanish flu. That was an avian flu origin that got mixed and with human, and it caused a pandemic. And every pandemic, influenza pandemic since then, 1957, 1968, and 2009, it was that you could trace back to those avian influenza origins. So that's why this is concerning. It's by itself, it's not going to cause a problem, but it's when it starts getting mixed, that's when it's a problem.
Okay. Another listener wrote in, Dr. Pate, saying, I am fairly new in Boise. I have found it very difficult to find a good primary care physician or internist to manage my care. Every physician with a profile that looks good online or that has been recommended to me is not accepting new patients. So can Dr. Pate suggest an approach to find a new physician? And why is it so difficult to find someone here?
Well, I sympathize with you. Even myself, when I moved here in 2009, it took me months to get into my primary care doctor. So one of the problems is we've had a shortage to begin with. The more recent problems is that we've had a couple of events that are just making it harder for us to recruit physicians. One is the legislature has, since the beginning of the pandemic, really been acting in a way that has been hostile to the healthcare community in many different ways. And so that just makes it harder for us to recruit physicians. And I don't see much of a change coming. And then the other big change was we had a large private group that was unfortunately that Intermountain Healthcare had acquired, and it kind of blew up. And so we lost some physicians there. So it is hard. It's not impossible. So things you can do is, one is you could pick your health system that you'd like to get your care from, whether St. Luke's or St. Al's. You can go to their websites and look at physicians. And I haven't looked at St. Al's, but I know the St. Luke's site does indicate which physicians are accepting new patients. So that's one option. Another is that you could call the Idaho Medical Association and ask for a list of physicians in your specific area that are accepting new patients. Or since he said he is in Boise, the Ada County Medical Society, you could call them and get help as well. So those are some suggestions, but yes, it is a problem. But both health systems are working actively to try to recruit more physicians, and hopefully we wish them a lot of success.
Yeah, absolutely. So Jan has an interesting question. She writes in saying, I'm 75 and generally healthy. Menopause started in my late 50s. I'm very active and eat a good diet, and I've always had a flat belly. I now have a noticeable increase in belly fat in spite of maintaining good exercise and diet habits. I really hate this and wonder if I can do anything to change it.
Well, Jan, first of all, let me commend you. Achieving 75 and being so healthy and having such good, healthy behaviors, I applaud you. Second, I would caution, I'm not an expert in this area. What I can tell you is that a lot of things that are promoted commercially that, oh, well, this will help you flatten your belly, you know, this diet or this supplement. I just am not aware of any evidence to suggest that those things work. If it's just a redistribution of your body fat, unless there's a medical condition, like you've come down with diabetes or something, there's probably not much you can do about it. If you've had an overall weight gain, you might just talk to your doctor. There may be perhaps a shift in the kinds of exercise you're doing. And then, of course, there is a new specialty. And we do actually have some board certified physicians in this area here in at least Meridian, I know. I'm not sure about where else, but physicians certified in lifestyle medicine, and they're real experts in this area, which I am not. So that's another possibility. Talk to your doctor, or maybe consider talking to one of these lifestyle medicine board certified physicians.
And Dr. Pate, Donna writes in and she says, Dr. Pate recommends getting another COVID vaccine 4 months after the last one. Well, my last one was in March, but when I called my pharmacist, she said I have to wait until the updated shot becomes available. And Dr. Pate, I will add that when I went in May to get my updated shot, same thing. And they said, well, you already had the one that's out, so you have to wait for the next one.
Yes, unfortunately. So the good news is that pharmacist administered vaccines has improved availability. So that's been a really good thing, and it's made it convenient for a lot of people. The bad side is, unlike the physicians, they can't exercise much discretion from the strict guidelines given by the FDA. And so the key would be, so your pharmacist is not being wrong. They're just, they're kind of, they've got their hands tied. So get in touch with your doctor and see if your doctor agrees that based on your age, your medical problems, medications you're taking, whatever, that you're at higher risk. And if so, if the doctor just makes the order for the vaccine, then they can do that and you can get that. But I do recognize a lot of people have had that challenge.
Mm-hmm. So Dr. Pate, before I let you go then today, as we wait for the next COVID vaccine to come out, hopefully in September or so, here we are in July, potentially getting ready to see another COVID surge. What should we be doing if maybe, let's say our doctors say, you know, you're fine. You just have a couple months to wait and you'll get that new vaccine. Should we just, you know, go on as life is as usual?
Well, no, the evidence is mounting and really becoming quite conclusive that the more times you get infected, the greater the risk for long COVID, as well as a number of other potential health complications. So I certainly would take precautions not to get infected. Be sure that you look at the guidelines yourself and see if you meet them, and then make sure that your physician understands that and gives you the okay for the vaccine, or check with somebody else. But the other thing is take precautions, especially in high-risk situations. We've talked about particularly the risks in international airports, international travel. I would still, as we see surges, I would still then back down from very crowded events. Consider your masking or in public areas where there are going to be a lot of people, and because you really don't want to keep getting it reinfected. And if you do get infected, then keep in mind that if you are over 50, you have medical problems, you're at higher risk, get in touch with your doctor right away to see if you qualify for an antiviral such as Paxlovid, because and we have another treatment as well that can reduce the chances for long COVID and complications. So those are all things to consider.
Well, as always, Dr. Pate, we so appreciate you taking time to talk with us and answer our listener questions as well. So remember, if you have a public health question for Dr. Pate, send it to us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu, and we will do our best to answer it next week. But as always, Dr. Pate, thanks so much.
Thank you, Gemma.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.